Back now with the head-on collision between the president's claims and reality.
So I put a piece of pipe through my hand just under a week ago, and I have been home all week because of it. Now, there's a couple of things that led up to this. One, the guys that I work with aren't all that great at doing their job when they help me out. And then, of course, the other thing is the only reason I maintain this other job is so that I can have health insurance. That on its face is absolutely crazy. So I ended up having to be rushed to the hospital because I was bleeding pretty good and I was unable to drive myself. The gentleman that ended up driving me, at first, when you talk to somebody, especially if you don't talk to them all that often, you start up with some light conversation. Generally, maybe it's the weather. Oh man, this weather. You know, this, that, and the other. Oh, how was your New Year's? That kind of thing. Then something funny happened when we got to the emergency room. There is a screen in the emergency room that tells you, as soon as you check in, where you're at on the list. I got in there relatively early, and even though there were people in there before me, I'd say at least 5-6 other people, my name ended up first on the list. So it was a waiting room that was shared by 3 different offices, and I said, oh, okay, these folks are obviously for those other offices, you know, those other 2 offices, and when my office is ready for me, you know, the doctor that's going to see me, I'll go ahead and I'll go in. And then other folks start getting called up. And in my head, I says, it's fine. There's 2 other offices in here, not just the emergency room. You know, they're medical offices, but they all share the same waiting room. And I said, when it's my time, they'll go, you know, I'm first on the list. They'll go and they'll call me in. 1, 2, 3 people got called in. And then the gentleman who was sitting with me, because he had to drive me back to work or back to home, turns to me and he points at his skin. He says, this is the reason they're not calling us back. And I said, what? Because we're white. Because we're white. Not because this office is being shared by two other offices that are all, okay. It's because we're white, huh? He says, yeah. I've seen this before. He says, I've seen this before in waiting rooms and they call up everyone else that's brown first before they call you up. I thought that was interesting. And so I'm able to have these conversations with folks without leaving any blood on the floor. First thing, you don't want to, you goddamn racist, you don't want to do that. That doesn't do any good. You don't want to yell, you don't want to call names. I start with some questions. And so, that's real. You really think that's what it is? And then he sort of gives his reasoning. Okay. And it moves into the wall, inevitably. And I said, no, stupid wall, not going to do any good. You know, people fly planes, people dig trenches. It's not going to do any good. And no, it is. It absolutely is. You know, walls stop people. Walls work. It's a 12th century solution to a 21st century problem. It's not going to work. He was convinced. I'm not going to keep hammering on him because you have to realize at some point you're not going to change their mind, but you do want them to keep talking to you because this is what we need. You need to talk to the other side. You need to try to understand them. And maybe after you get through enough of their reasons, perhaps you can talk a little bit of sense into them. I kept talking with this individual, and eventually, so already there's a racial problem here. He's dealing with some white grievance. He thinks that he's being treated badly because he's white, not being treated badly because I'm white, and I know I'm not being treated badly because I'm white, and I realize what's going on inside this office, and it's got nothing to do with the color of my skin. And so this individual ended up opening up so much to me that they admitted, you know, they're an older man, probably in their 50s now. They admitted, they said, I used to be horribly, horribly, horribly racist. You know, I'm probably adding a few horriblies there, but they said something along the super racist, somewhere, I'm paraphrasing. And I said, why? Why did that happen to you? How do you think you got that way? I pointed out that I grew up in African-American neighborhoods, and when I was younger, I played with African-American children, you know, before we got into grade school, but something happened once we got into grade school, and the lessons of their parents got to them, and then it became a problem. It became a problem that I was white. I still had plenty of African-American friends, but there were a few families that lived inside of that economic prison that believed that because the white man put them there, held them there, brought them to this country, that the white man was the problem. Even though I myself am a child, white is the problem. So yeah, I got beaten up plenty of times for being white while I was a child, but I never let it turn me against African-American people. And he points out that his father worked at a really good paying job. His father was approaching retirement. He was approaching work age. And he talked to the boss and says, hey, you know, since my father is so prized here, then you're definitely going to want somebody from the same bloodline in here. Keep your company going. And the boss agreed. He says, absolutely. But you got to apply for it just like everyone else does. And so he applies for it. And the job goes to an African-American man. So he goes back to the boss and he says, I'm sorry, I kind of thought I was a shoo-in, you know, nepotism and all the rest. And he goes, no, I'm really sorry about that. I had to hire this other guy. Why? Because, well, there's too many white people working here. We got a quota to fill. And that day forward, by his own admission, up until he had children, from that day forward, by his own admission, he hated African-American people. Said, you know what? F them all. Hated Mexican people too. Blamed them. And then he said when he had children and his children started bringing their friends around, he said it was really hard to maintain that. He realized the ridiculousness in maintaining that racism and he doesn't carry it anymore. But he kind of does, because he just got done saying to me a little bit ago that the reason that we weren't being picked is because we were white. These are very tough conversations to have. And you have to handle them with kid gloves. You can't go off on these folks. You really should listen to their grievances, even if you believe that their grievances are complete crap and are not based in reality. You still have to listen to these folks. When I came home, I said to my wife, you know, I got to talk to so-and-so today, and here are his positions. And my wife just about dropped everything. And I heard a gasp come from all of my children. Oh my God, what did you say to him? What did I say to him? I talked to him like he's a human being. I talked to him as though all of his concerns were legitimate, but while providing some challenge to them so that I can understand them. I don't see this person every day, but I see them with enough frequency that I think I might be able to be a positive influence. So let's take a couple of these examples. First of all, his father getting passed up. Let's just say that there was a requirement because of affirmative action. He can't have nothing but white people working at his job because it does look bad. First and foremost, if that story is true, and I have to take it as so, okay, I have to take it as so, then you can't get mad at the person that got the job. See, we have a lot of racist employers in America, especially if you go to a place like the Deep South. There really is a lot of racism, and they bust their ass to make sure that they mistreat people of color. So we need a policy like that. The gentleman that got hired over your father, it is not his fault. And I think to some degree, he eventually realized that. Once you start seeing the world through your kid's eyes, that's the kind of thing that tends to happen. Whenever you think that you're being picked on because of your color and you are white, you really need to reassess the situation. When I was walking into the emergency room, I saw there were three signs out the door. I take stock of I know all of my surroundings. I know every single thing around me. I know every single exit, almost sometimes before I even walk into a room. So when I didn't go first and ended up going maybe 10 minutes later, I knew what was up. But if you really believe that the world is picking on you because you are white, then what you're going to end up doing is just assuming every time something goes wrong in your life, gosh dang it, it's because I'm white. And you're handicapping yourself when you do that. And without you maybe even realizing it, you're narrowing your own mind. I pointed out that my wife and I had, at one point, considered moving to Canada. His response to me was that Canada will take anybody. So, I said, no, that's not true. Actually, we've looked into it, and they'll take my wife because she's a professional, but I'm an effing DJ, and they won't take me. And he was surprised by that, like genuinely surprised. And I said, I wanted to go there for the healthcare system. Our healthcare system here is horrible. And he said, no, no, no. And I find another thing with the healthcare system as it, with respect to Northern Europe and with Canada, people see what they want to see. Now, if you look at absolute numbers, all the other countries that have a competent, helpful healthcare system, they're absolute numbers. How long people live, infant mortality, things like that stuff, that those numbers don't lie. But there's always something anecdotal from folks that are already against those kinds of systems where they'll say, well, I know somebody and it was horrible for them. It's so horrible. It's so bad. Well, here's what I do know. They have better outcomes. It's way cheaper and nobody goes into debt for healthcare. Story I heard about a woman a while ago where she talked about how she got hurt in a really remote area. Had to do a life flight. So they did the life flight for her. They take her to the hospital. She spends about a week in the hospital. She gets out. She gets a bill for $50. $50? What the hell is that for? $50 is to, I think it was $50. It was a copay for the life flight. And that was it. And I said, that's the kind of thing I need. But they said, wait, what about the wait times? What about the wait times? It's according to need. Just like with any good system, it's according to need. If I walk into the emergency room and I'm holding my guts in my hands, I'm definitely going to get back in the back room faster than this dude that just smashed his thumb with a hammer. It's according to need. So back to where I started with this freaking wall that has shut down our government for a month now. Walls work! Oh yeah, walls work! No, walls don't work. The wall, as I've maintained this entire time, is little more than a monolithic symbol of racism for a racist president and a love note to his racist base. Because even Trump doesn't believe in walls.
Never, ever give up. Don't give up. Don't allow it to happen. If there's a concrete wall in front of you, go through it, go over it, go around it, but get to the other side of that wall.
It's interesting that he says that. Get to the other side of that wall. Go ahead and go through it. So there have been prototypes, samples, I suppose, built on the southern border because they got Trump down there smacking his putt around over how excited he is about these damn walls or slats or whatever President Ding Dong is calling them now. And NBC News decided to go down there to the wall with some tools that they bought from, I'm not kidding, just your average local hardware store. This isn't industrial stuff that you need to be a city worker to buy. They went down there with tools that you can buy at your local hardware store, and they discovered something crazy interesting.
Yeah, this is the exact type of wall or fencing or slats or whatever you want to call it, Andrea, that President Trump has selected and has said the Democrats have agreed to put along the southern border. And we have known for quite some time that DHS, the Trump administration, has tested 8 different types of border barrier wall fencing down in the San Diego area. And all 8 of those were breached, tested by both the military and the Border Patrol's tactical unit. But we haven't seen pictures of that until today. And as you've mentioned, NBC News has exclusively obtained that image of the steel barrier that was sawed through with what the report says is a quick saw, something that you could pick up at Home Depot. It's sort of a household tool or a common tool used by people that deal with materials like steel or other types of building materials. And the president did say today nothing is impenetrable, but it's just ridiculous to hear him say that, because for so long the president has said an impenetrable border barrier is what is critical to border security. And not only that, he had staked this entire shutdown on putting a $5.7 billion wall at the middle of the debate that he says will solve both a humanitarian and a security crisis. And we know that the facts just do not support that. And now there's another reality, Andrea. This steel barrier that the president wants can be cut clear through with something you could buy at your local hardware store.
Waste, fraud, and abuse. That's what we're told of. Waste, fraud, government waste, fraud, and abuse. So your stupid wall isn't going to fix the problem for any number of reasons. Boats, planes, tunnels come to mind. The fact that most people get into this country illegally, say somebody comes here radicalized or comes here and gets radicalized via the internet. The way that happens more often than not is with folks overstaying their visas. You could do something about that problem, but clearly the wall isn't the answer. And so they asked the White House, they go, you can cut right through the damn wall with some saws that you can buy at your local hardware store. And they said, hey, this is just part of how we're going to deal with the problem on the waste, fraud, and abuse. The damn wall isn't going to do any good. And we know that now. But the president still insists that we have to spend $5.7 billion on the wall. But wait! $5.7 billion? We have to spend... Yo, I thought Mexico was going to pay for this.
The new trade deal we have with Mexico and Canada, what we save on that just with Mexico will pay for the wall many times over just in a period of a year, 2 years, and 3 years. So I view that as... Absolutely, Mexico is paying for the wall.
It's not Mexico paying for the wall. There is no deal. We've made no money. It's crap. It's an excuse because he's now been caught because he accidentally became president. And the shutdown at this point has now far exceeded the $5.7 billion cost. So even though Ding Dong did not get his $5.7 billion for maybe his 3 miles of wall, understand this thing is going to cost a hell of a lot more. Or maybe he only wants to build one section of it. That way he can take selfies in front of it and go, look, we're a lot safer now, because the truth is the number of people that are coming into this country illegally has been dropping for decades now, year after year after year. And it drops precipitously after the 2008 crash. They ignore that though. But if they can build this one section of wall, and the president can take a selfie in front of his monolithic symbol of racism, it is at that point that they will begin to recognize publicly, look, the number of people coming into the country, it's going down. And then it will be pointed out to Sarah Huckabee Sanders, it's been going down for 2 decades now, to which she will say, you're fake news and I'm no longer calling on you. Next question.
Thank you so much to this. The government shutdown is about to cost more than Trump's wall. Ready? I'm going to say that one more time. The cost of the shutdown is greater than Trump's wall, even though Ali will argue the wall is going to cost way more than $5.7 billion.
Correct.
We're going to break
it's
down...
It's more than what he's asking for the wall. Let's put it that way.
We're going to break down just how much our economy is losing because of the president's demands for a wall. Not border security, a wall.
So the headline over at The Hill is McConnell blocks House bill to reopen the government for a second time. Right now, we're talking about hashtag Where's Mitch? This was started by AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez herself, because 800,000 people who directly work for the government are not receiving their paychecks right now. Any number of them are days or weeks away from being homeless or having to go live with family members. And then there's a million more contracts and millions of more people than that who are indirectly affected because they're watching their family members suffer so that Dum Dum can get his stupid wall. And the thing that I hear, whether it be local news or national news, is that these Democrats, remember, Trump couldn't get this through when he had both houses of Congress, the House and the Senate. He could not get his damn wall money through. And that's all his party. Gosh dang it, why don't the Democrats and President Trump just work this out? Hold on a second. There's one more factor that's not being talked about, and that's Mitch McConnell. So the Democrats keep passing bills to reopen the government or reopen parts of the government. And every time it lands on Mitch's desk, he simply says, we're not even going to bring this up for a vote. And the reason he doesn't bring it up for a vote is because he knows it would pass. And it would pass because there's two problems. For Republican constituencies, they're being hurt as well. And they are not happy about this as well. But Mitch McConnell knows that if he brings that bill up and they have to vote to reopen the government without wall funding, they're going to have tough re-elections because they kept selling this effing wall to all of the white Christian racists in the deep southern states. So he simply decides not to bring it up. They could pass it in the House. They've passed it, no problem. They could pass it in the Senate with a veto-proof majority. And the president would have to sign it. There'd be no excuses at that point. But Mitch McConnell can't have that. And Mitch McConnell's absolutely getting none of the blame for this right now. When, hey, the Democrats have done their part. And Dum Dum will do his part after Mitch passes the freaking bill that was passed by the House. But I can tell you right now, if I turned on my television out here, why don't the Democrats? Why don't President Trump? President Trump could call for both houses just to do it, and then they would just do it. The Democrats are already doing it. There's one more factor in this, and that's Mitch McConnell and the people of Kentucky, who I assume some of them are good people, keep voting for this monster. $5.7 billion from these deep southern states that say that they hate waste, fraud, and abuse. $5.7 billion. We've already lost way more than that because of this stupid shutdown. But my. What could we do with $5.7 billion?
Let's say you took 5.7. You took the president at his word. $5.7. It could give all 3.2 million public school teachers in America a $1,700 a year raise, and we'd still have $260 million left over. Or, you don't think teachers are the priority? How about nurses? There's 3.3 million registered nurses in America. They could also get a $1,700 raise, and we'd have $90 million left over. And the president has talked about his dedication to helping treat substance abuse. Well, that wall money could triple the budget of the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration, which helps millions of Americans find the support they need. And then there are poor Americans. Okay, we got 3.7% unemployment. We got a lot of poverty. We got 40 million people who are food insecure. Add $100 million to the president's ask for that border wall, and the government could pay an extra month of supplemental nutritional assistance programs, SNAP, commonly known as food stamps, to more than 40 million struggling Americans who are food insecure. Why do we have 40 million Americans who are food insecure in the world's richest countries? Well, that's where that money can go. These are just a few of the priorities the president could look into rather than having shut down the government about a wall that's going to cost more than $5.7 billion and punishing workers for what is essentially a policy fight.
Donald Trump has said it's fine. People don't really mind the shutdown because, you know what? This, according to NBC News, most of the people that are furloughed are Democrats anyway. He's not the president for everybody. He's only the president for Republicans. And he says, and besides, people are with me. People love shutdowns.
The people that are on the receiving end will make adjustments. They always do. And they'll make adjustments. People understand exactly what's going on. But many of those people that won't be receiving a paycheck, many of those people agree 100% with what I'm doing.
I love hearing rich white people telling me that it's fine, I'll just make an adjustment. Hell, maybe I can just go to my father and ask for a small $1 million loan. It may seem like just another thing, one more thing that he does because he's not that smart. But I think it's a lot worse than that. I think a large part of this is maliciousness. Because do you know who loves the shutdown even more than Donald Trump loves the shutdown? Vladimir Putin.
In regards to Russian involvement in the midterm elections, we continue to see a pervasive messaging campaign by Russia to try to weaken and divide the United States.
Our democracy itself is in the crosshairs. Free and fair elections are the cornerstone of our democracy, and it has become clear that they are the target of our adversaries who seek, as the DNI just said, to sow discord and undermine our way of life.
Make no mistake, the scope of this foreign influence threat is both broad and deep.
With the Mueller report about to come out here in probably anywhere between 3 and 6 weeks, pieces of it are getting out already. And I don't know if there are leaks necessarily, because the Mueller investigation has been as airtight as anything. But Carl Bernstein was recently on CNN's Reliable Sources, and he said, and I quote, that the Mueller draft report, and he's seen the draft report, says that Trump helped Putin to destabilize the United States, whether it comes to NATO. And of course, let's talk about Syria. The White House put out a video saying that we have defeated ISIS, and they are on the run, and there's no more of them left, and we're going to go ahead and pull out of Syria. And we had an attack this week where a cafe where a lot of our soldiers go to eat was bombed, and it was bombed on video. I think we lost somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 to 8 soldiers. But of course, Hillary Clinton isn't the Secretary of State and Barack Obama's not the president. So the fact that those soldiers got effing murdered by this group that Trump said was defeated is okay. And they're not going to start a 4, 6, or 7 year investigation like with Benghazi to look into it, because it's okay because Trump is president while it happened. The Secretary of State is not, it's fine. It's okay because it's not a Democrat in charge. I had a guest on this show back during the 2016 election, and I got pretty tight with this guy for a little while because both of us were Bernie-crats. Of course, I think that we both still are. And after I decided to get in the Hillary Clinton camp, he more or less disowned me and just began to troll me because he was unhappy because it's Bernie or bust. And of course, what ended up happening was bust, because now Donald Trump is president. And I was looking back at those old messages that he and I used to share, and the very last message that he sent to me was, isn't it pathetic, and I'm paraphrasing here, about how the Democrats are now backpedaling and all the Russia stuff, pointing out that, of course, the Russia stuff is BS and that never happened, because, of course, this guy doesn't have to accept reality, because, hey, if we stick with Bernie, even if Bernie is not the nominee, then, of course, Bernie will automatically become president. Just vote for Bernie anyway, because that's the way elections work. And I'm not going to reach out to this individual, because they did get really cruel and really pissy and really mean, and I don't think that there's any place for that. Remember, whether you agree or disagree with people, you need to, and you can have policy differences, but you need to be able to have conversations with people without, as the old saying goes, leaving blood on the floor. But I so badly wanted to reach out now and say, now that it's pretty damn clear the president works for Russia, that he had a Russian deal going at the time, that we have the Internet Research Agency, that Vladimir Putin was doing all this stuff to help him out, that now the pollsters, we know that the Republicans in Trump's camp, that his campaign manager was sharing polling data with the Russians. Now, why would the campaign collude and share polling data with the Russians?
Well, you want it because you're in the midst of crafting an active measures campaign, a covert action campaign sponsored by the Russian Federation, by the Kremlin, by Putin himself, to direct the GRU to interfere in the election and to support the campaign of Donald Trump. And to do that effectively, you actually have to know where your leverage will have an impact, where you can maximize your social media campaign, when and where you should be dumping the hacked emails that you obtained illegally, as shown in the Mueller indictments of the GRU officials. And so any finished analysis, any data analytics, any insights that were not publicly available, any campaign proprietary information that the Trump campaign moved to the Russians through this cutout and ultimately to Oleg Deripaska could have been used in the Russian campaign.
Rachel Maddow has taken a ton of heat for the fact that she has been on this stuff and on this stuff like crazy, trying to tell us, beaming about it. Hey, this is happening. This is happening. Here's the evidence. And she took a ton of heat for it. Rachel is good at this stuff. And I have been following her for, man, it's probably 15 years now, because way back in her radio days, her and Tom Hartman were the only shows that I would make sure to never miss. And I was living West Coast, still am, but what I'm saying is noon to 3 would be Tom Hartman, and then 3 to, I think, 6 would be Rachel Maddow. And the interesting thing about Rachel Maddow was that she didn't do, I do a lot in this show because it's my thing, is she didn't do a lot of audio clips and she did almost no guests. It was just her just straight up delivering the news, and I loved that. And when MSNBC picked her up, I just, I had to wait till the smartphone came around for me, which took about a year or so. But as soon as it did, I immediately found her show, and I've not missed a day of listening to her show. And I think 9 years now. Sometimes I won't listen if the B team comes in, but whenever it's her, I make sure to never, ever miss the show. And the world has finally seen what I have seen for all of these years.
The conservative political figures who you can most count on to threaten to sue you and call your boss and scream about their victimization as loud as they can whenever they get mentioned by name in a way they do not control are, of course, the Koch brothers, Charles and David Koch, who inherited a privately held oil and chemical company from their dad and thereby became almost unimaginably wealthy. If Charles and David Koch were one Koch brother instead of two, if they were one guy, they would in fact be the second richest guy on earth. They really do not want anyone reporting any connection between what those groups do and who gives them the money that they do it with. The Koch brothers' letter to us includes a script that they want me to read to you on the air, denouncing my own reporting on the Florida drug test the poor story and telling you that they are not involved in promoting any such issue. You not wanting to be known for something that you have done is not the same thing as you not having done it. I will not read scripts provided to me by anyone else. I do not play requests.
There is nobody too powerful that she will not take them on, that she will not get into their face, and that she will lock onto them. She will coil around them like a snake. It's she's awesome, and she's finally number one. The headline over at Forbes, MSNBC's Rachel Maddow hits number one with long, complicated segments that viewers love. She had one show about a week or two ago where she went for 27 minutes. That is unheard of in cable news. Remember, the way these companies make their money is by folks tuning in and staying. And that's why they've got these panels. Because if you don't like the host, maybe you like one of the people on the panel. You know, just anything to hold you there. And then lots of flashy graphics. And she talked for 27 minutes, giving all of the nuance that we need to hear. Tom Hartman is running a thing right now where he says, you know what? Maybe we need to find a way to get some of our messaging down to a bumper sticker. And he's been running sort of an informal contest on his show. Hey, help me design a bumper sticker. And people call in with all these slogans. And I think it's a fine idea, but I don't do it. I do an hour-long show, not because I'm so freaking important, because I'm the world's smartest man. It's because I've got this information and I would like to disseminate this information to you. And I can't do it in 10 minutes, 30 minutes, or even just with a freaking bumper sticker. I think you need to know it. I think you need to know the nuance. I think you need to know all the little details. I think you need to know why and when and how, and you need a time frame. All of this stuff is super duper important, and that's why I don't simply shine a flashlight in your face, bark at you, and then walk away. I know that may not make a lot of sense to you, but that's just the way I run things. So congrats to Rachel. Hard work and persistence will eventually pay off. Of course, she's been at that show for, I think, 10 or 11 years now. I've been at this one for about six, damn, going on seven. Oh, I hate the fact that I have to walk away from it, but obviously it's really hard to keep all this stuff up when you don't have a team. But my persistence to this point, and I just want people to have this information. And even once I walk away from this microphone, I want you to just keep looking into this stuff. The information is out there. Start watching, start listening, start looking around. It's all there for you. But it's not going to just present itself to you. You have to find, there's no good information. Everybody's biased. It's not true. You just have to work a little harder. Because when I'm not here to be the storyteller, and when she's not there to be the storyteller, you're still going to have to find a way to stay informed. It's too important. Democracy is far too important. Because of her relentless reporting, and the fact that there are people that actually care about this, we now have Giuliani, the president's lawyer, finally saying, okay, yeah, fine, there was some collusion.
Giving poll data up leading to this coincidence.
Well, you just misstated my position. I never said there was no collusion between the campaign or between people in the campaign.
Yes,
I have no idea. I said the president of the United States. There is not a single bit of evidence the president of the United States committed the only crime you could commit here, conspired with the Russians to hack the DNC.
So initially the story was that nobody in the campaign did it. And then the story was, well, Maybe some people in the campaign did it, but it definitely wasn't Trump. And what you'll hear next go around is, hey, that's old news. Why are you still talking about this? Because you said there was no collusion. We never, ever said there was no collusion.
Trump campaign Russia collusion.
Gone.
It's gone. Okay.
Is it still the position of you and your client that there was no collusion with the Russians whatsoever on behalf of the Trump campaign?
Correct.
There has been no collusion between the Trump campaign and Russians.
Between me and my campaign and the Russians.
Between the Trump campaign and the Russian people. There's no collusion with Russia. To say it one time again, and I say it all the time, there was no collusion. I didn't know the president. There was nobody to collude with. There was no collusion with the campaign.
There's a group of dedicated journalists that are camped out in Trump's D.C. hotel, which is the old post office. And what they're taking note of is who is staying at Trump's hotel, which in effect is who is giving Trump money indirectly. And so the case being built against him with respect to the emoluments clause is building now because of those journalists who would not take no for an answer, who would not simply realize the president said, stay away from my business. I'm doing nothing wrong. And they knew that he was doing something wrong and they've stuck to it. And now there is a case being built against the president with respect to the emoluments clause.
Who has all sorts of obligations to that power, who's dealing not only with Russia but with China, having them put $500 million into his portfolio, violating the emoluments clause, then giving a special deal to ZTE, endangering our security. When all of that explodes, it could be quite nuclear. And the idea that the people will simply stand for it and that Republicans will not suddenly grow a spine, I think, is premature. We don't really know. I mean, we certainly know that getting 67 senators to vote to convict is almost impossible. It's never happened. But there's always a first time. And if there's any president who has tempted the country to see whether the safeguard that the framers put in place against a renegade president who cares more about himself than about the country, this might be that president.
A couple of old white racists bet on Trump, and they lost. The Republican Party bet on Trump, and they lost. The United States voter, the average American, voted on Trump, bet on Trump, and they lost. There's a headline, this from Business Insider, people who bet on how many lies Trump would tell during his Oval Office address won more than $270,000. In the UK, there's a website called bookmaker.eu, and it went like this. They offered odds of negative 145 for more than 3.5 lies and plus 115 for fewer than 3.5 lies, meaning that if a person bet $145 on Trump telling four or more lies, they would win an additional $100. And the company, bookmaker.eu, in one of the biggest defeats in their history, ended up losing $276,424 because they underestimated how many times the president would lie during that 8-minute address that he gave in prime time about a week and a half ago. Almost $270,000 that they lost because, hey, they bet on the just like everyone else did. Starting to feel alone out here. I'm one of the few people that didn't bet on this dum-dum. And then there's this, the headline from Newsweek. This is just sort of the bonzo stuff that's going on with our government right now while it's shut down. Donald Trump's son is trying to say, this is Eric, this isn't Junior. Eric is pushing the idea on Twitter, and this is how they keep the rubes entertained while the government shutdown is going on. But his son, Eric Trump, is pushing a conspiracy that Ellen DeGeneres, who is a leftist talk show host, okay, that she is actually running a shadow government. This is real. Now, it's no secret that Ellen DeGeneres does not like the president and has said that he is not invited to come on her show. And yes, she has had presidents on in the past. She's had President Obama several times and Michelle Obama a couple of times. And it's not just about Ellen DeGeneres being to the left. It's about the fact that she's not going to have a homophobe on her show. And I understand the obvious problem here with the fact that she had Kevin Hart on, because Kevin Hart came on and he still would not apologize. But she has refused to promote this president because of the way that he treats the LGBT community. I suppose it's a lot easier to talk about this stuff than it is to point out that we now know that Trump ordered his personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress. He told his lawyer that he should commit a felony. And we also know from recent reports that Trump had his lawyer pay for fake polls during the election. And they say, hey, this is a sitting president. You cannot indict a sitting president. As that clip pointed out earlier, all of these things, all these checks and balances that we have in place, all of these tests, all these things we have in place to put a check on somebody that has this much power are going to be tested by this guy.
There's an awful Office of Legal Counsel memo in the Department of Justice. I think it dates back to the Nixon years, but maybe I'm wrong. But it states that a sitting president should not be indicted. That's not a rule. It's not a law, but it's a suggestion from the Justice Department.
I think actually when you look at the OLC opinions, there is a very powerful case to be made that you can indict a sitting president. It's more difficult to make the case that they should be tried while they're in office, because that would be very disruptive of the president's responsibilities. But the only argument, and it was really not the focus of attention in those prior OLC opinions, the only argument was made was that it would stigmatize the president.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Justice Department already crossed that Rubicon when they said individual number one, the president, was implicated in these two crimes. So that has already, that bar has already been passed.
While all this is going on right now, William Barr is in front of the Senate. And by the way, William Barr is very likely going to get confirmed. No two ways about it. William Barr is going to get confirmed. And here's why. Because William Barr was the guy that instructed George W. Bush in the 11th hour of his presidency in December of the year while he was an outgoing president, December 1992. He was the guy that said that George H.W. Bush, the guy that just died, what he should do is he should pardon everyone that was in trouble from the Iran-Contra affair. Just pardon them all. And he says you should say that it is a way to heal the nation, when really what it was a cover-up. He was AG at that time, and he's about to be AG again. Why did Trump pick this guy? Because this guy believes what Trump believes. And this guy, it's believed, that is going to shut down the Mueller investigation because he has said as much. Now that he's in front of the Senate, he's saying, no, that's not what I'm here for. That's not what I'm going to do. Don't be like that. But we know that that's what he plans to do because he has said so both in his spoken words and in his writing. And there's a couple of things to know about William Barr. First of all, he does not believe that we have enough people in prison.
During your previous tenure as Attorney General, you literally wrote the book on mass incarceration, or at least wrote this report, The Case for More Incarceration. You argue that we as a nation were, quote, incarcerating too few criminals.
In those days.
And that the solution was more incarceration for more people.
Please, sir. For chronic violent offenders and gun offenders.
Well, I mean, that's the challenge, sir. And you argued against the bipartisan legislation in 2015 quite strenuously.
I did.
But that's not the nature of incarceration in this country. In fiscal year 2016, only 7.7% of the federal prison population was convicted of violent crimes. Overwhelmingly, what was initiated in those times that led to an 800% increase in the federal prison population, overwhelmingly, that was nonviolent drug offenders. Except right now, our federal prison population is overwhelmingly nonviolent. 47.5% of the federal prison population are incarcerated for drug offenses. And I guess
Cory Booker and the Democrats are trying. Cory Booker is there pointing out the prisons are full. And the prisons are full with nonviolent offenders. Do you really believe that we don't have enough people in prison and that maybe we should continue with these policies that end up locking up not criminals, but locking up disproportionately people of color and people that are poor? Because as the old saying goes, it's better to be rich and guilty than poor and innocent. Do you think that that is a good system? for us.
Cancer says it treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. And you see disproportionately, overwhelmingly for drug crimes, African-Americans and Latinos being incarcerated. The importance of your job, and I'll ask you this last question, because you haven't met with me yet. You've given that courtesy to others. Would you please meet with me in my office so you and I can have a heart-to-heart on the urgency, the cancer on the soul of our country's criminal justice system is the disproportionate impact of that system on those vulnerable communities, including women, over 80% of whom the women we incarcerate, are survivors of sexual trauma. Can you and I sit down and have a longer conversation than these 10 minutes will allow on this issue?
I'd very much welcome that, Senator.
Quoting from a March 3rd article that appeared at Forbes.com, the Cole memo, C-O-L-E, the Cole memo, was a policy memo created during the Obama administration that mostly protected marijuana legal states from federal scrutiny. Now, the Trump administration, via U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, has decided to rescind that guidance. Many observers across the political spectrum concur that the decision will heighten uncertainty in an industry that is seeking stability. So what it means is the states, the Cole memo says, the states that have legalized marijuana, they are going to, the federal government is going to leave their hands the hell off of them, even though marijuana is still federally illegal. Jeff Sessions came out and said, he hates marijuana, good people don't smoke marijuana. And so Jeff Sessions is out, not because of that, but because he wouldn't protect Trump from a Russia investigation. So here we have William Barr. Mr. Barr, how do you feel about Mary Jane?
I think the current situation is untenable and really has to be addressed. It's almost like a backdoor nullification of federal law. To me, it's a binary choice. Either we have a federal law that applies to everybody.
And so, I'm sorry to interrupt you, sir, but how would you address that? Do you think it's appropriate to use federal resources to target, you know, marijuana businesses that are in compliance with state law?
No, I'm not going to go after companies that have relied on the Cole memorandum. However, we either should have a federal law that prohibits marijuana everywhere, which I would support myself, because I think it's a mistake to back off on marijuana. However, if we want a federal approach, if we want states to have their own laws, then let's get there and let's get there the right way.
I don't entirely disagree with him. We do need to have just a blanket legalization. No more of this dumb drug laws, especially with respect to the way we handle marijuana. It's not a problem. Just let it go. But here comes another attorney general that's not going to respect the Cole memorandum, which protects those states that do pass legal marijuana laws, and is going to start cracking down on these states again, creating more uncertainty in this industry. And I will never understand. I have to think that it's racial, that they think that they can lock up more black people, and they do, as opposed to white people when they cast them with marijuana, because the way that we treat marijuana makes no sense. And I say this not as a pothead, but as a person who really believes what conservatives say they believe in, and that is to end wasteful government spending. It's wasteful to lock up people for marijuana. It's wasteful to use our police resources and to build prisons to lock up people that use marijuana. Just like the wall, this is insane, and I can't believe that this is a thing. And of course, there's another problem with William Barr. Not only does he have his nose placed firmly up Donald Trump's ass, but he also believes in the idea, and I'm not kidding here, he also believes in the idea of jailing journalists.
My dad was a reporter, so I grew up knowing the importance of a free press. We obviously have the tragic case of a journalist who worked right here at the Washington Post, Jamal Khashoggi, and it's a particular concern. So I want to ask you something I ask Attorney General Sessions. If you're confirmed, will the Justice Department jail reporters for doing their jobs?
I think that, I know there are guidelines in place, and I can conceive of situations where, as a last resort, and where a news organization has run through a red flag or something like that, knows that they're putting out stuff that will hurt the country,
There might be a there could be a situation where someone would be held in contempt, but
well, Attorney General Sessions had said he was going to look at potentially changing those rules at one point. So I'd like you to maybe respond in writing to this, because that was very concerning. And
the silence in that clip when he's asked, that is the most striking part to me about that clip, the silence, because do you believe in jailing journalists for doing their job? The answer should be no. And there shouldn't be any more than a 1 second gap between the finish of her question and your answer. No. But instead there was silence, and he points out when it's okay. Like, let's say that journalists are hurting America. The headline here from Forbes once again. New congressional marijuana bill is actually numbered H.R. 920, and a hat tip to the marijuana culture. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill have officially reserved H.R. 420 for a bill that would dramatically change federal cannabis laws. So here's the thing. The government is shut down, but even once the government reopens, there are tons of things that need to be taken care of before we take care of the marijuana issue. And so what the way it goes in the House, the first bill that comes up is H.R. 1, next bill that comes up is H.R. 2, next bill that comes up is H.R. 3. But in the House, they've jumped all the way ahead and set up H.R. 420 to be the marijuana bill that dramatically changes our marijuana laws for when they eventually get around to it. They're not the first person, first group of folks to do this. California did this as well. So they're signaling their intentions that they're going to change our marijuana laws, and I think that that is a very, very good thing. If you are really, truly concerned about wasteful government spending, then you should not get behind the idea of a $5.7 billion wall that's not going to fix the problem, that can easily be cut through with tools that just about anybody can get their hands on. And instead, you should be spending that money on schools and on teachers and on infrastructure. If you really are against wasteful government spending, then you need not spend so much of our money fighting people that are smoking a plant or that are making clothes out of hemp. Now, hemp is finally legal, but cannabis is not, and it needs to be in all 50 states. Piece of pipe, and I mentioned this, piece of pipe went through my hand earlier this week, and I'm off all week from my driving job because of it. Soon as I get done at the damn hospital getting sewn up, I gotta go take a drug test. Why? Because they need a reason to fire me if they find any marijuana in my system. Now, it doesn't mean that I was high at the time. Hell, I could have smoked it a week ago and you could still find it in my piss. The fact that a piece of pipe went through my hand is not my fault. But if I smoked marijuana a week ago, seems to me they're just looking for an excuse to can me. And that's not the way it should be. It didn't go through my hand because I was high. It went through my hand because of what some other dum-dum did. And the fact that my employer can still demand my piss, hey, it's clean, fine, but it's still absolutely effing stupid that that part of it has to happen and that I got to go into a laboratory. I got to put all my stuff in a closet. I got to lift up my hat. I've got to pad my pockets and show the person in the laboratory that I didn't bring in any fake piss with me. That's insane that I'm treated like a criminal after somebody put a piece of freaking pipe through my hand. I got rear-ended in my work truck about 2 months ago, and I'm pretty certain that when my insurance premium comes due again, they're gonna call me out and they're gonna say, hey, you got rear-ended, we're raising your rates. I stopped at a red light. I did everything that I was supposed to, but you got rear-ended, it had to be your fault, we're raising your rates. The fact that we punish victims is insane to me. Ladies and gentlemen, I am not rich, so I do not enjoy the benefits of being rich. And there's a lot of people who keep voting for these same politicians who are pretty damn sure that they need Republicans and that they need Republican policies because dag nabbit, they're not rich right now, but holy hell, they're going to be rich one of these days and no Democrat is going to be standing in their way and taxing their money when they become millionaires. They're not millionaires now because they're being tested by God or whatever. But they need these politicians because when they become millionaires, they need these politicians on their side. I think conservative folks realize in their heart of hearts that Republicans are only protecting millionaires, millionaire criminals, millionaire millionaires. And then, of course, you've got your sociopaths that do all kinds of damage to the government and to the environment. But that's okay because they still need those folks on their side when they become millionaires. Stop. The other thing that it does, that conservative policy does, is it makes certain that the millionaires that are already there will become even bigger millionaires. And that you, a working person, will never, ever, 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 ever become a millionaire. You may not realize that. Hell, Lucy's put the football in front of you so many times, you ought to know by now that she's just going to pull it away, but somehow you don't manage to learn that. I had more stuff to talk about. I had more stories, but I ran out of time, and I know I didn't do the same divider that I do in my other shows where I play a piece of music in the middle just to sort of break up the show a little bit, but I got on a roll today, and I was unable to stop talking, and I really only paused to use the restroom. I just couldn't get away from what I had to say to everybody here today. This is episode number 281. I do enjoy our time together, and I'll be very sad when it comes to an end, but I want to say to you, please stay involved in this stuff. You know, as they say, the arc of history is long, but it does tend to bend towards justice. And don't lose hope. You know, despair is not an option. You have to stay involved in this stuff. You have to stay engaged. You got to keep your head up. Slogan, slogan, slogan. Yeah, it's true. It's all slogans. But man, these words, they're important to me. And I hope that they're important to you. And I want to thank you so much for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on the Podbean app. You know, you can subscribe for the time that we have left. We're always happy to have you. Questions, comments, hate mail, just a general statement or inquiry, you email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to inform and to entertain. Feel free to reach out to us. And thank you so much for listening. With a fire you can't put out, and we will. I promise you, we will prevail. Rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and thank you for listening. This is Melvin, signing off. Now that I have woken you up, good morning.